today.
Are you tired of living with stained and worn-out carpeting? Does the den look like bears spent the winter with you? Spring is here, and so is Empire Today's half-off your project sales, starting now, but only for a limited time. Save 50% on a huge selection of carpet, hardwood, and laminate, standard padding and materials, and basic installation. Call the Empire Today half-off your project sale hotline now.
1-855-385-0681.
Empire Today's free in-home estimates are easy and smart. Choose from high-quality flooring in the rooms where you'll use them, with your lighting, so you can see the color best. We'll do the measuring. You do the selecting and saving. But first, you must do the calling. Everyone loves the half-off your project sale. Even bears. Call the Empire Today special hotline.
1-855-385-0681. 1-855-385-0681.
Empire Today.
Select styles. Details at empiretoday.com.
You are listening to AJ Radio.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the program. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. How's everyone doing?
Doing good.
We'd like to invite our listeners to give us a call or join us in the chat room if you have any questions or comments. If you'd like to join in on the conversation with a question or comment, you can give us a call at 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. And we'd love to have you join in with us. This evening, we're going to be talking about the challenges faced by public defenders. And we're going to have a couple of folks joining us this evening to talk about that. They will be on a little bit later. And that's going to be Jonathan Rapping. He is the founder and president of an organization called Gideon's Promise. And it's an advocacy group for criminal justice reform. And so he's going to be talking about some of the challenges that face public defenders. And then also joining us will be Jacinta Hall. And she is an assistant public defender from Memphis, Tennessee. And she'll be able to chime in on that discussion as well. And we have quite a bit of information that we can share from knowledge that we have in dealing with the IRP6 case. Before we get too far, though, Lisa, let's do our disclaimer.
Okay, we just want to remind everyone that we are not attorneys and that A Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide any legal advice. You want to contact your own personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast. And as always, we want to thank you for choosing to tune in and spend a little time with us this evening.
And like to also let's kind of jump to one of the things as far as something that was in the news currently. You know, last show we talked a little bit about the Ferguson, Missouri case and how the DOJ report really cited a lot of racism, systemic racism within the Ferguson Police Department, and then they had a shooting where someone shot two police officers, and you know they did pick up that gentleman on Sunday, and you know that's one of the things where, you know, everyone at first there was all kinds of speculation as to it being a setup and all this kind of nonsense, but this gentleman who he claims that he was not targeting the police. I guess their investigation will you know prove out as to what was going on there. But, you know, you've had all kinds of responses to this. I saw in one situation today where the lieutenant governor of Missouri, and he had the audacity to come out and say that President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder are more racist than the Missouri Police Department. Can you believe that?
That's a joke.
Yeah, that's I saw that as well. You know, these people just will not take responsibility. They always want to deflect the focus off of them. The bottom line is, regardless of who pulled the trigger, in a crowd, in a protest, whatever the case was. The bottom line is that Ferguson Police Department is racist, and they have done things improperly and violated the rights and civil rights of the citizens of Ferguson, and nothing that happens beyond that is going to change that.
And, you know, one of the things when he said that about the president and the attorney general, he tried to state that the DOJ report was lopsided, if you will. Yet the president and the attorney general, I mean, the report, they came out very clearly and said that they were not going to file any charges against Officer Wilson. And mm-hmm. I believe Holder has spoke on that and said, you know, that they found that they were not going to file any charges against Wilson. So I failed to see what the lieutenant governor of Missouri is saying when you got the president of the United States, the attorney general of the United States, are not going after a headhunting mission to try and bring down Wilson.
No.
And then also after the shooting, the president and the attorney general, again, they came out and were very straightforward about the fact that I'll just put it in my terms. It's not cool to be targeting the police. I mean, you know,
no, it's not.
Regardless of the circumstances that led up to the protests and so forth, you know, our law enforcement officers will not, should not be targeted. And, you know, and we've talked about it here before where, you know, they have families, and
yes, they
their families are waiting on them to come home in the evening. So I don't know where this lieutenant governor of Missouri is getting off by saying this stuff.
Well, I wonder, had the report reflected that there was wrongdoing or the police department showed to be efficient, in some ways. And like you said, the attorney general as well as the president has come out publicly condemning that action with law enforcement, and President Obama has made it clear that he doesn't believe all departments are like this, but you have rotten apples in every level of government and law enforcement. They're just there, but it seems to be a trend that was going on, and again, we don't condone violence in any way, regardless of the injustice that happens, and as I said last week, we need the same outrage for Michael Brown's death that they gave to these officers as a result of them being targeted.
That's right.
There needs to be a balance with that.
Absolutely.
And then the bottom line is people are going to react when they feel they have been unjustly done.
And, you know, the lieutenant governor's name is Peter Kinder, I believe. Is that the way you say it? Either Kinder or Kinder, K-I-N-D-E-R. And so, you know, he's just... But he has a record of kind of being out there. You know, he's out there somewhere on his own. All right, let's shift gears. We haven't talked about the IRP-6 in any, you know, great detail lately. So there's been a recent turn of events this week regarding the judge that presided over the IRP-6 case, and that judge being Judge Christine Arguello. Now, just to give you our listeners a little bit of background, the IRP-6 are David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. We would invite you to go out to the website that was set up for the IRP-6, and it is freetheirp6, that's the number 6.org. Out on that website, again, it's freetheirp6.org. You will find information about the IRP-6 case. You'll find profiles on the gentlemen themselves, background on their company, which was IRP Solutions Corporation, and then a lot of the court documents. Now, in at a high level, the IRP-6 case involves these six gentlemen. They had a company called IRP Solutions Corporation. They developed software for law enforcement. The software is called Case Investigative Lifecycle, and this software would allow law enforcement to more effectively and efficiently communicate at all levels, whether you're talking local level, state level, federal level, and it would also support interdepartmental communications. So the company started in 2003. In 2005, the company was raided by the FBI. with the gentleman being falsely accused of wrongdoing. Case eventually went to trial in 2011, and even before the trial, there were so many errors that have occurred in this case, and that's why A Just Cause continues to fight for them. But at any rate, there were two grand juries that were impaneled for this case. The first grand jury said that this is a debt collection case, which it is. If you go out to freetheirp6.org, you will see that it is a debt collection case. Well, the federal prosecutor, Matthew Kirsch, impaneled a second grand jury, calling only one witness, which was a FBI agent, Robert Moen, and he got his indictment. The case went to trial in 2011, and during that trial, there was a speedy trial violation. Judge Arguello did not allow expert witnesses to testify. Judge Arguello violated the gentleman's Fifth Amendment right by forcing them to take the witness stand. And then, and also the gentleman had had a motion for the judge to recuse herself because of her connections with several other players involved in this case. As far as the judge is concerned, and Cliff, we've talked about this many times, as and you talk about it in terms of the judge being a referee, ensuring that it's a balanced proceedings, and ensuring that the person who was accused, or the persons in this case, receive a fair trial. And Judge Arguello did not see that. She was biased, and we have a lot of information that leads to that points to how she was biased. Now, recently, Judge Arguello, the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, had a ruling that ruled against Judge Arguello in another case. And so, and before you go there, Cliff, I just want to point out to our listeners that we have we've pointed out how Judge Arguello treated the IRP6 one way, and then in other cases acted just the opposite. I mean, she ruled in the Delta Petroleum case and said that the executives of that company had every right to speak positive about their company, that there was nothing wrong about building up their company, and the fact that investors lost hundreds of millions of dollars investing in that company, that there was nothing wrong with that, and she dismissed their case.
Right, and this article that you're talking about, Sam, it just points at, you know, like you say, a judge should be a referee, but when a judge comes to the realization, I mean, these federal judges, they're put on the bench, they get a lifetime appointment, they're not accountable to anybody, and we as a Just Cause have found that to be true. I mean, you would think members of the public would probably think, oh, no, if a judge does something wrong, then you can report them to somebody. Who do you think that somebody is? Well, maybe the chief judge of the circuit, or maybe the Judicial Oversight Committee, or maybe the Office of Professional Responsibility. All these places that you think, well, maybe Department of Justice
the
would be the one.
Judicial Conference.
Right. All these 20, 30 places that we've gone to as a Just Cause to say, hey, this judge, Christine Arguello, in the 10th Circuit, is doing things that are just outside of the realms of what a judge should do. But when you come to the realization that, you know, the judges get to basically play all these games with the law. They get to do what they want to do, and unless they are explicitly called, unless the things like in this case, this was part of the transcript, that they were able to come back on Judge Arguello with. But if the judge does not allow, as in the IRP6 case, if the judge does not allow that part of the transcript where she basically made, you know, what they call a quote-unquote egregious error, if she doesn't allow that part of the transcript to be released or included to what the defendants are given as their case file, then what do you do in that situation? We're finding out again that there is no particular place that you go that says, okay, this place can force a judge to give up the transcript. We had another judge here in Colorado in a civil case against the court reporter who didn't release this portion of the transcript where Judge Arguello violated the IRP6 Fifth Amendment right, and we still got no relief from that judge. And so when you look at this case where it basically the title of it, and it came out yesterday, It was in Law 360. The title of it is 10th Circuit Chides Jury Instruction in EEOC, so Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or something, blind worker row. And so basically this was the case where this blind worker sued this beverage company here in Denver, Colorado, saying that they discriminated against him because he was blind. The whole thing was, you cannot do this job as a blind man. You're going to get yourself hurt and you're going to get somebody else hurt. How do you sue a company to say, okay, if you don't have a driver's license, you can't drive? How are you going to be a pizza delivery guy? If you're blind, how are you going to be on the assembly line saying, I'm able to do this job that that I applied for? And in this situation, Judge Arguello basically, and this I'm sure will sound familiar to those who are familiar with the IRP6 case, gave the wrong jury instruction. She basically told the jury that they had to rely on some particular standard in the instructions that would cause this man to not only get his job back, but also to get a monetary settlement. And this is what the 10th Circuit of Appeals said. It says the panel said that the jury might have relied on the incorrect standard when it rendered a verdict mostly in favor of the agency. And it says, we conclude, and this is the judge's writing, we conclude that the jury might have relied on the erroneous direct threat standard. Thus, reversal is warranted, the panel said. The incorrect standard appeared prominently in the instruction, and the verdict form directed the jury to consider that erroneous standard. Because the instruction in verdict form could have misled the jury on the standard, we must reverse. So basically, Judge Arguello verbally told the jury, this is the standard that you must lean on when you come to a conclusion about this case. Then she wrote it in their jury instruction during deliberation. This is what you have to lean on in this case. Now, I'm not familiar enough with this case to know whether she had interest on either side of this. But when a judge is pushing that hard to one particular standard, why are you pushing that hard for that one standard? Is it because you know that this will get the verdict, this will get the outcome that you are seeking as a judge when you're supposed to be the referee to say you two sides go against each other? What was her intent in this situation?
Well, it bigger than that, it shows a pattern.
Yes.
Here. Now, if a judge, when a three panel judges come to this conclusion that the panel said, as you just said, the jury might have relied on the incorrect standard,
right?
Which means this is jury
manipulation.
But you're influencing the jury towards most favorable to the plaintiff,
right?
That is exactly which we. According to the inappropriate conduct that we believe Judge Arguello did in regards to the instruction to the jury, what was said to the jurors that they felt threatened, a lot of these things here.
Exactly.
So this is not, you know, let's not make no mistake about it. This is not a small thing here.
No, this is not a small matter at all. This is a judge. This basically is a judge interfering in the
process,
and in the outcome of a trial. And I mean, we've seen that with this judge before. When you are basically telling a jury, no, you must rely on this portion of the instruction that's going to ensure that this party is guilty or this party loses the trial. When you look at what the panel said, they said in sum, the instruction was erroneous, the panel said. The first part of the instruction inaccurately stated that beverage distributors, that was the defendant, had to prove that Mr. Sangala, that's the blind man, that he posed a direct threat. And the second part of the instruction did not cure the error by directing the jury without explanation. Here's another thing with Judge Arguello not explaining why she did something in court. Just like she's not explaining why she says in open court in the IRP 6 case, there is something that I said during the proceedings that does not show up on the record. It's not in the transcript. Where's your explanation that it's not in the transcript? Why is it that your court reporter wouldn't record that? First, she said, well, maybe the defendants didn't stand close enough to the mic. Maybe the court reporter's headphones fell off, this or that. Who cares if the defendant stood close enough to the mic? We're talking about your words as a judge. You know where the microphone is at. You know that you're supposed to be close to it. And you know that if your court reporter didn't take down your words, that there is something wrong there. You should basically fix that problem. So you can't say, well, the defendants weren't close enough to the mic. What about you, Judge? Were you not close enough to the mic? Did you cover your mic so that your words wouldn't be heard? But it says that that the second part of the instruction did not cure the error, that she put an error out there. Basically, if you really want to look at this in layman's terms, it's saying the judge used her opinion to ensure that this beverage company had to pay this man and give him his money back, because the instructions she gave to the jury were not even they made no sense. And then she gave a second instruction without any explanation as to why she gave it. She did not cure the error by directing the jury, again without explanation, to consider the reasonableness of the beverage distributor's belief. How incredible is it to believe that a blind man cannot work on an assembly line? How do you tell a jury, no, they should let him work on the assembly line? He's blind, he's going to get himself injured, and he's going to get somebody else injured. That is a reasonable belief. Why do you tell the jury don't accept that?
Well, if you know the definition of erroneous, definition of erroneous is this: it is based on or containing error, incorrect, deviating from what is right. To deviate from what is right means
right.
That is an intention.
Yes,
that is an action that you took to deviate from what is right, and to stray from what is right or proper. So when the court states that this was erroneous, that's not, well, this was a mistake.
Right.
This was a deviation from
proof. A deviation from what is right.
And what is proper.
Yes. You saw the proper path, and you deviated off of that path to go in another direction.
That's an act you took.
And as the Tenth Circuit panel says, without explanation.
Without explanation.
And you know, Cliff, one thing that comes to mind when I look at this with regard to the IRP 6 is the IRP 6 argument to discuss intent.
Yes.
And everyone that has reviewed the IRP 6 case do not get it, and we don't either, as to why Judge Arguello was so adamant about refusing to allow the IRP 6 to talk about intent in front of the jury. That's because if the jury had heard the IRP 6 talk about what their intentions were, there would not have been a conviction. Just like in the first grand jury, there was not an indictment. Just like during the first grand jury, the IRP 6, David Zappolo, he took in documents to the grand jury and showed them what IRP was all about, what the company did, and the purpose for the company and so forth. There was no way you could return an indictment.
Exactly. And just like in this case where it says that without explanation, she didn't tell the jury to consider the reasonableness of the beverage company's belief. That's exactly what she did in the IRP 6
mm-hmm.
case.
Yep.
I'm instructing you, you can't deal with the intent that the reasonableness of their belief that they were developing, marketing, and trying to sell their product.
Which was real.
Right, which was real.
Proven by
Cala Forensics.
Yep.
Proven by
sworn affidavits.
Right, sworn
by retired law enforcement, federal law enforcement.
And John Smith had interviewed Department of Homeland Security, FBI, New York Police Department. He had gone to all these places, and they said they saw the software.
So there was no scam.
Right, there was no scam, but she would not allow the intent to be presented to the jury. It is exactly what this is, to consider the reasonableness of, and I'm going to replace beverage distributor with defendants, the reasonableness of the defendant's belief. If you never intend, if your intent was not to commit a crime but to develop, market and sell your product, that is called business. If you go into debt doing that, that is normal day-to-day business. That is not a crime.
And by any other name in Judge Arguello's courtroom, that would have been called Delta Petroleum, which she
exactly.
said there's nothing wrong with that.
Exactly.
Well, and the bad part about this is that you cannot give jury instruction on paper It's kind of like giving jury instruction and the judge highlights something that we want you to focus on.
Right.
You can't do that. You're supposed to render a verdict based on the evidence without any influence from the judge, which means when she basically took a position and like the judges said, would have leaned towards the jury finding in favor of the agency.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that a judge, again, it's not even supposed to be a part of. The judge steps away. It is a matter of fact of jury instruction. There is no emotion. There is no influence. There is no leaning forward. They are bound by the law based upon the evidence that's presented in that case, the lack thereof.
And that is why the three-judge panel says, because the instruction and verdict form could have misled the jury on the standard, you misled the jury on the standard of what the instruction was. Basically, the standard is allow the jury to come to a conclusion.
On their
based
own.
Based on reasonable belief of the defendant and based on the evidence, allow them to come to a conclusion. You misled the jury on the standard. They said we must reverse this case.
And I think they said in that point that they would have to prove more. The more information, basically, the jury would have to take more information into account.
Right.
That was not necessary. So yeah. It makes you wonder again, back to the IRP 6 case, what information did you instruct that jury? How you, as we said before, the tone was set in that courtroom
yes.
by the judge. The influence was already there. And what's amazing to me is that on a jury instruction, that is a separate hearing that happens outside of the jury.
Yes.
That is supposed to be agreed upon by both parties.
Right, but they said that her faulty instruction is what may have swayed the jury. So they could have come to a conclusion on instruction, but she presented it
in an improper.
She's a crook, so. You
know. Well, and you know, it also puts folks in a situation where, you know, for all practical purposes, you can't get a fair trial.
Yes, exactly.
And the trial should be about, you know, disclosing, exposing. The truth, and unless a jury has all the information, how can they make a valid decision? I mean, even in the IRP 6 case, the jury came back to the judge and asked, you know, have we seen everything?
Right.
Is this all the evidence?
You think she gave them any more?
Didn't give them anything. And so, you know, that's like you were both just saying, it just shows that the system needs a major overhaul, and when you have a single judge, we've seen it that from one case to another, it almost depends on what the season, you know, how she's going to rule on one thing versus another. But I for one, was shocked that the Court of Appeals put her feet to the fire on this one. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. For more information on the IRP6, we were just talking about, that's David Banks, Dave Zapolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Jerry Walker. We invite you to go out to freetheirp6.org. When we come back, we're going to jump into a discussion talking about the challenges that face public defenders. We have a couple of guests that's going to be joining us in just a little bit. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Hey, guys. I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Jared Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Blue.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
Do something good for your community.
Reuse bags and bottles and always recycle.
Help us collect 1 million pounds of food.
Help people prepare for natural disasters.
Do something about homelessness.
Anyone could be a rock star in their community.
So then do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Visit dosomething.org to find out how.
Didn't talk about it.
I've got to go home.
Oh, come on, Carrie. We're going to a new place.
She wants to go home, right? Go.
Whoa. You okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You sure?
Relax.
What's a few beers?
If you don't stop your friend from drinking and driving, you're as
good as dead. Drinking and driving can kill a friendship.
Can you imagine spending 20 years of your life in prison for a crime you didn't commit? Neither could I, until I got the opportunity to portray Betty Ann Waters in the film Conviction, telling the real story of how she freed her brother Kenny. Sadly, what happened to Kenny happens far more often than you might expect. But together, we can stop it. Please join me in helping the Innocence Project fight injustice. Go to innocenceproject.org to make a donation and get involved.
Thanks for listening to AJC Radio. Call in at 347-838-8976 and share your stories and comments about judicial injustice. Be a part of the AJC Radio Show every Tuesday and Thursday night, 6 p.m. Mountain, 8 p.m. Eastern. The number again, 347-838-8976 or www.blogtalkradio.com and search for A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
We have a big problem, and we need your help.
It's happening on college campuses, at bars, at parties, even in high schools.
It's happening to our sisters and our daughters.
Our wives and our friends.
It's called sexual assault, and it has to stop. We have to stop it. So listen up.
If she doesn't consent, or if she can't consent, it's rape, it's assault.
It's a crime. It's wrong.
If I saw it happening, I was taught you have to do something about it.
If I saw it happening, I speak up.
If I saw it happening, I'd never blame her. I'd help her.
Because I don't want to be a part of the problem. I want to be a part of the solution.
We need all of you to be part of the solution. This is about respect. It's about responsibility.
It's up to all of us to put an end to sexual assault. And that starts with you.
Because one is too many.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. We'd like to thank our listening audience for taking time out of your evening to join us. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. And we were just talking about the IRP6, and I know, Lisa, every now and then we like to encourage our listeners to help out the families of the IRP6. What are we asking our listeners to do?
Well, we're asking everyone to go out to GoFundMe.com and do a search out there on IRP6. You'll find a place where you're able to read a little history on the families and a link where you can donate to those families as well, to the children and to the spouses that are left behind of these men who've been wrongfully incarcerated for going on 3 years now. If you, like I said, you go to GoFundMe.com and do a search on IRP6, and you'll find that link and have the opportunity to donate.
Excellent. And, you know, we would appreciate that support. And, you know, we talk about it from time to time, how folks don't realize the impact of, you know, a loved one being wrongfully convicted, wrongfully incarcerated, and you're the breadwinner in your family. And incarceration affects more than just the person who is incarcerated. And obviously, when you have a situation where folks are wrongfully convicted, it's even more so of an impact, not just the financial part of it, but even the psychological part of it and the just the, you know, the whole family atmosphere. So we appreciate your support. Okay, this evening we're going to be talking about challenges faced by public defenders. And Lamont, I know we've talked about this quite a bit, and from your own personal experiences, you have a lot of stories to share, both on the positive as well as the negative, on the positive side, as far as public defenders that were very instrumental in your appeal and in your exoneration, and to prove that you were wrongfully convicted, and you talk about that from time to time here on the program. But then we've also talked about how public defenders, they get that rap that you got a public defender, the caseload, the workload that they have is just tremendous. And so someone that knows a lot about that firsthand is Jonathan Rapping. And Mr. Rapping is the founder and president of Gideon's Promise, which is an advocacy group in Atlanta that is fighting for criminal justice reform. And there is a lot of press out there right now that's talking about, as far as the pay that they receive, the workload, and so forth. So, Mr. Rapping, thank you for joining the program. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well, Sam. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So talk to us a little bit about Gideon's Promise, and then we'll start batting around the discussion on public defenders.
Sure. Gideon's Promise is an organization that my wife and I founded 8 years ago after I moved to Georgia to become the training director for a statewide public defender system here. Spent a couple years working in Georgia, went to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, did some work in Alabama and Mississippi, and really started to see how criminal justice systems have just come to accept this embarrassingly low standard of justice for poor people. And I met these young, passionate public defenders who came into this work for all the right reasons, but just had the passion beaten out of them after a while. And so Gideon's Promise was founded as an organization to provide training and support to public defenders to inspire them and give them strategies to push back against unjust systems and ultimately build a movement to try to drive criminal justice reform where it's needed the most.
And, I don't know if you saw, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, where attorney Gary Spence, he spoke, and he actually was speaking on this subject, and he made the comment. He said, "I have great respect for public defenders, but what if the public defender has 100 cases, and what if the public defender is only a public defender in name?" Then he says, "Let me tell you something. If I had 100 cases, I'd have to plead him guilty." And this is a man who has a reputation as a defense attorney who never lost a case. But the point that he was making here is that as a defense attorney, for all practical purposes, aside from any pro bono work that he did, but as a paid defense attorney, he could take the time that he needed to strategize, put together an effective counsel, as far as, how are we going to approach this? He wasn't being, a stack of manila envelopes or folders weren't stacked on his desk and he meets someone, 2 hours before they go to trial. So I don't know if you read that or not, but it sounds like that's what Gideon's Promise is about, is to try and, correct some of that kind of thing.
Well, that's exactly what it is. I did read that, and I think, Jerry Spence is correct. Even the best lawyers in the country, if you put them in a situation where they have more cases than they can handle, and they don't have the resources that you and I would demand and we would pay for if we were in trouble, they are going to be forced to watch clients fall through the cracks. And what that does to a lawyer's psyche is it really starts to wear you down. It really starts to make you want to quit. You start to feel like a failure. And I think what we do at Gideon's Promise is we say to our lawyers, look, we can't teach you to handle 100 cases in a day or 500 cases in a year. But what we can do is we can start to help you. Instead of watching 500 people fall through the cracks, let's think about how you can start to maybe try to save 50 of them this year and maybe get better and save 75 next year. And instead of focusing on all of the injustice beyond your control, try to figure out how you can help as many people as you can while we build a movement to reform this system so down the road public defenders don't have to handle 300, 400, 500 cases a year. But we need a community of advocates, and right now our community of public defenders, through no fault of their own, have been beaten down and worn down for the very reasons Jerry Spence identifies.
And Mr. Rapping, Lamont Banks here. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks, Lamont.
I had an opportunity to see the HBO films Gideon's Army. I presume
yes.
You had
a
big. I was so fascinated and moved by that program. I had no idea of the struggles that public defenders face, and I think this is something that bothers me about the situation, which is so strange, is that the justice system was set up for fairness for all, whether it's the prosecution and whether it's the defense. What question I have above anything else is that public defenders are state employees. Is that correct?
The state has the responsibility, but some states have punted that responsibility to counties. The state does have the responsibility to ensure that.
And this was my concern, was that that the gap that's actually, as far as resources that are available to public defenders, as far as the state salaried attorneys who work full time on behalf of clients, they can't pay for a lawyer, but the Commonwealth, the state, and the prosecution. How do you have a system set up, and this is just a question, and you can chime in on this. How do you have a system set up where the prosecution are given all the resources they need to prosecute you, but the defense, who is paid, and this is just a general statement, but they're paid out the same pot. How the resources divided are so lopsided that the prosecution can have all the resources that they have to prosecute you and convict you, yet the defense is struggling for bodies. The workload is far pressing. It's an overburden for these attorneys. How does a state sit in good conscience and say that they are providing justice or due process when the resources are so lopsided from the state defense?
So, Lamont, that's an excellent question, and I believe the answer is it's a reflection of our societal values. And our societal values right now are aligned with law enforcement. We have come to dehumanize the populations of people who find themselves in the criminal justice system, and those people are almost exclusively poor and disproportionately people of color. We have sufficiently otherized, demonized those communities, so we see them as evil. And so we root for the prosecutor, and we root for the police officer, and we see the defense lawyer as trying to sort of help free people that endanger our communities. But what I think is so interesting is if you go back 52 years to when Gideon versus Wainwright was decided, and that was the case that said that a lawyer is the vehicle necessary to ensure justice, that a layperson can't get justice in a complex criminal justice system without a lawyer, and if we believe in equal justice, we have to make sure poor people have the kinds of lawyers you and I would pay for. You have to remember that case was decided the same year as the March on Washington, the same year as the same era as our country was grappling with the fact that we have deprived poor people and people of color basic civil rights. And so really Gideon was a civil rights case. It was an era when we were starting to care about justice. And what's happened over the last 40 years with the war on drugs and with all of this tough on crime posturing is that our priorities have shifted away from basic civil rights. We pretend that we've achieved those civil rights, and we've now moved on to a tough-on-crime, lock-em-up mentality, and we don't see the people in the criminal justice system as our community members. We see them as others. But let me just finish by saying that's a grave mistake, because the people who are in the criminal justice system really are the people who pick up our trash in the mornings. They serve us at restaurants. They are the people we go to church with and their sons and their daughters. And by dehumanizing a population of people, we've made it easy to accept a system that is punitive and that is destroying communities.
And it says here, I just want to throw a couple of information out to you, a study by the American Bar Association, but I wanted to show you this. It shows that the prosecutor is paid an annual salary, and this is a average amount, of $97,404, according to projections, for the upcoming fiscal year, while the lawyer for the accused gets $66,000. That's one gap financially, right? And then it says here, 2004, I didn't mean to interrupt you. You had a point?
No, go ahead. I'll let you finish, and then I'll say
okay. Okay, Mr. Rapping, and it says here that in 2004 study by the American Bar Association pointed out that in a sampling of 11 states, Virginia ranked dead last in average indigent defendant cost per case, and the lack of resources had led to substandard practice in those cases becoming the norm. As you said, and we talk about on this program a lot, the culture has become that. And says that one specific finding, the report said, was partly to blame a sizable gap in the resources, available to public defenders, the state salaried attorneys who work full time on behalf of clients who can't pay for a lawyer, and Commonwealth's attorneys, their prosecutorial counterparts. So the Bar Association, through their studies and through their research, they have found, as you were just sharing, the gap. And I think it is a culture issue that, you know, when I was wrongfully convicted, Mr. Rapping, in this state, and I remember the judge making this point to the jury. He said there's an automatic prestige that comes with the office of the prosecution, of the district attorney's office, that when a jury comes into a courtroom, they believe, and I think it goes to the resources that they have, and they don't seem to be struggling to put on their case or this and that. They don't have the struggles that a public defender, as we're talking about tonight, have. And when that is demonstrated in front of a jury, you can't find hardly anybody on the street in a 7-Eleven, in a McDonald's. If you say, well, do you have an attorney? PD. You know, oh, man, exactly. you got a PD, man. Well, man, you know, you really need to get it. I mean, that's just the culture. It's the thought process, as you said, that our society has adopted to accept. So I agree with you on your points. I think it's a tragic situation. Do you see a way that we can find our way out of this?
Well, let me tell you one thing that's going on right now before I answer that question, Lamont. So you know, in Tennessee right now, and we're going to be joined, I know, by Jacinta Hall, who's one of the public defenders from Gideon's Promise in Memphis. But they have a rule called the 75% rule. And what that rule says is the state provides funding for public defenders. And if the county wants to increase funding for prosecutors to supplement what the state pays, it has to also, for every dollar it gives to prosecutors, it has to give 75 cents to the public defender. Now, 75 cents to a dollar still isn't equal, but at least right. It's an attempt to make sure the gap doesn't get too large. Well, there is a bill that is proposed, and right now in Tennessee they are debating doing away with that, what they call the 75% rule, because they feel that public defenders shouldn't even get that. So your point, there is a value that we place on locking human beings away. But for some reason, we don't place that same value on making sure that liberty is protected, right? Which is something that is fundamental to our Constitution and our democracy. So you ask if we see a way out. I will tell you this. I'm an optimist, and I believe we can do this, but I don't think it'll be easy. I think the way out is we have to change a criminal justice narrative. that sees police and prosecutors as good guys.
Right.
Everyone accused of a crime is bad guys. And I think it's going to take work. We're going to have to change that narrative and change values to do that.
Thank you so much for that, Mr. Rapping. That makes a lot of sense.
This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Joining us this evening, Jonathan Rapping, founder and president of Gideon's Promise, which is an advocacy group that's fighting for criminal justice reform, specifically talking about public defenders. And our subject this evening is challenges faced by public defenders. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, Mr. Rapping is going to stay with us, but we're also going to be joined by Jacinta Hall. She is an assistant public defender in Memphis, Tennessee. And so you don't want to go anywhere. This is an excellent conversation we're having on this subject, so we look forward to that when we get back. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
My boyfriend dumped me, I still have to finish my research project, and my parents' divorce is tearing me apart.
Does this sound like you?
I just feel hopeless.
Someone is always there to help. Don't give up. When you feel like you don't belong, talk about it. Never keep things locked inside. If you need help, please call the suicide hotline number 1-800-273-8255. Your life matters. Don't give up.
The United States of America incarcerates more people than any other country in the world. In fact, the U.S. hosts more prison inmates than all other developed nations combined. As of 2010, the world population was over 6.8 billion people, with an estimated 9.8 million in jail. This figure, compiled by the International Center for Prison Studies, refers both to individuals held in jail awaiting trial and inmates serving time after sentencing. So there are 9.8 million human beings on planet Earth living inside of cages that we know of. In 2010, the U.S. was home to about 309 million people, 4.5% of the world's total population, but housed 23% of the world's prisoners. So take a moment to think about what this means. It means we imprison more people than enormous autocratic countries like China. We imprison more people than Russia. Compared to the size of our population, our rate of imprisonment dwarfs our closest allies, like the United Kingdom, France, and Canada. As of 2010, there were over 1.6 million post-trial inmates serving sentences in America's state and federal facilities. This number does not include those being detained pre-trial or those on probation. The most unique feature of incarceration in America is the large and active role of our federal government. In most countries, crime is reacted to at the local or regional level, whereas the American government finances and legislates a significant portion of law enforcement at the national level. State governments still do their fair share of incarceration, though. California and Texas incarcerate more than other states, with over 171,000 inmates each. Florida is a close third, with over 103,000 prisoners. But no single state locks up more people than the federal government, with over 208,000 inmates. Perhaps the nickname Land of the Free, Home of the Brave, should be updated. Though I suppose you need to be brave to endure the highest likelihood of incarceration the world has ever known. Prisons are not what we think about when we think of America, and they shouldn't have to be. A free nation shouldn't imprison so many people, and a fiscally responsible nation can't afford to. With close to $40 billion a year in state correctional spending, the financial costs are obvious and staggering alone, but the human costs are often underappreciated. 1.6 million fathers and mothers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters of American families are incarcerated. It's time for people to realize that the criminal justice system in America is desperately in need of reform.
Listening to AJC Radio.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. If you have a question or comment, please join in. Also, you can join in on the chat room online. Joining us this evening as we talk about challenges faced by public defenders is the president and founder and president of Gideon's Promise, which is an advocacy group out of Atlanta that is fighting for criminal justice system reform, and more specifically as it pertains to public defenders. Also joining us out of Tennessee is Jacinta Hall, and Ms. Hall is the assistant public defender and she is also a former board member and vice president of the Mississippi Public Defender's Office, and she's a graduate of the Gideon's Promise. So again, Mr. Rapping, thanks for joining us, and happy to have you here. And Ms. Hall, are you there?
Jacinta is going to join us in a little bit. Olivia's still trying to get her on the line.
Okay, so we end up losing her.
Yeah, but I do have a question, Mr. Rapping. This is Cliff Stewart. I also want to say we appreciate you being on the show tonight. But
thank you, Cliff.
With everything that that we've said, the point that Lamont brought up about this discrepancy in the pay and the salaries between the public defender and the prosecutor, although they are being paid out of the same pot, is absolutely amazing to me. With that point, but with Gideon's Promise, I mean, everything that you guys do, you know, providing coaching, training, professional development, mentorship, and a network of peers. With the lack of funding, I mean, what recourse do these public defenders take then? You know, the ones who really want to fight for justice, what recourse do they take? Because I know that here in Colorado, I believe that public defenders get paid for 70 hours, of work on a case. So once that 70 hours is expended, especially, you go through 18,000 pages of discovery, 70 hours are gone. So what does Gideon's Promise, how do you guys get past that and tell these public defenders that, hey, you keep going? What do they do as a recourse to not getting paid for doing their job?
It is a challenge, but I think what we do is the first thing we do is through recruitment. We are trying to identify public defenders who do this work not for the money. No one does this work for the money, but they truly are committed to what I call this generation's greatest civil rights struggle. They see this as a struggle for the most important ideals in our society. They believe in racial justice. They believe in equal justice. And so they're driven by something other than money. I think anyone who does this because they can't get another job and it's just something they're going to do to pay the bills until something else comes along, they're not going to do their clients justice because they don't get paid enough to work the hours that it takes. So step one is finding people who are motivated by the struggle. And so we bring them in and we try to help them do as good as they can. But what we do as much as anything, Cliff, is we try to help them stay inspired and survive when things go wrong beyond their control. I think what really defeats so many public defenders and leads to burnout is inevitably they're not going to be able to give every client what they deserve, and that can really wear you down. So we try to give them a supportive community to help them do the best they can for as many people as they can in the short run. The long run vision is we are building future leaders. We try to help them hang in there so they go from being new lawyers to supervisors to office heads. And we get a community of leaders across the South and ultimately across the nation who embrace these ideals. They will be the leaders who will push for change in the state houses, before the county commissions. And so we have to groom that community of advocates. Change won't happen overnight. step one is just trying to support these young, passionate folks while they learn to do this really hard job. Then we develop them into leaders.
So, Mr. Rapping, joining us on this conversation is Jacinta Hall. We now have Jacinta back on the line. So, Ms. Hall, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you?
We are doing great. Thanks for joining us. So what does Gideon's Promise mean to you, or what did it mean to you as a, you know, as a former graduate of that outstanding program?
Okay, it does. It still does. I am still affiliated with the program in a graduate role. And so for me, Gideon's Promise has meant everything for my criminal justice career. I never imagined myself doing this work. And once I had the opportunity to do it, I entered a great environment with great coworkers, but with absolutely no training. So it was all on-the-job training. And the office in which I started, which was the Hinds County Public Defender's Office in Jackson, Mississippi, I was representing felony clients. We didn't do misdemeanors in that office. And I was representing felony clients, all looking at a year or more of prison time, with absolutely no training. So being introduced to Gideon's Promise and the training that Gideon's Promise offered, the support that Gideon's Promise provided, was everything to me in this career, and it is one of the main reasons why I'm still doing this work.
So it's a it was a true baptism by fire situation, huh?
Absolutely.
So what was the caseload like when you first graduated from college, from law school, and you're at Hinds County, and you're thrust into the situation? I mean, I kind of, you know, without having any real firsthand knowledge of it earlier, I was just saying, hey, someone comes in and stacks a big stack of manila folders on your desk and say, hey, go at it. Is that kind of an accurate depiction?
That was literally what it was, except for my manila folders were inside of a banker's box. But that is exactly what it was. I came in bright-eyed and bushy-tailed on my first day, and they set a banker's box full of files, manila files, in front of me, and they said, here are your clients. And I had absolutely no idea what to do.
And Ms. Hall, it's Cliff Stewart. Now, I have, I guess, a two-part question for you. With what you went through, I mean, you're doing felony cases. You have people who are looking at prison time of at least a year. You're new to this. I'm sure the pressure had to be at some times where you felt like, you know, it's just unbearable. You have these people, you know, they're depending on you to get them off. You don't have proper training. And, I mean, how did you manage not getting burned out with that type of caseload? And then the second part of the question is, once you got affiliated with Gideon's Promise, how did that change your mindset to say, you know, I can wrap my mind around this, you know, I can do it, I can press forward, and I can give it everything that I have to fight for, just because that is I think the biggest thing when you say you got a public defender, like Lamont said, like, oh man, you better get you a real attorney, because all they're going to do is try to get you a plea deal. What gives you the drive to say, I'm going to fight for justice, even in the limited capacity as far as my salary and resources? How do you deal with that? How did you wrap your mind around that?
Okay, so for the first part question that you asked, how was I able to wrap my mind around it and feel comfortable and competent enough to do what I was doing without necessarily throwing clients away? I've always, the family that I came from is a very caring family, very giving family. So I grew up always knowing to care about other people. So even though I didn't necessarily have the tools or the best tools, because, you know, it was kind of try by fire. They didn't give me the worst of the worst cases. I didn't come out the gate trying murders or anything. But the cases that I was given, I was groomed through those cases and coworkers that I had in the office and the clients themselves, you know, just like, look, this is what we're going to do. If this is what you want, this is what I'm going to try to do for you. And they trusted me because even though I didn't have the proper tools, they could see that, hey, she's going to get out there and she's going to fight for me. So,
right.
And that's what I did. So the fire was there. I've always been called. I'm 5'1", but my mouth makes it sound as if I'm 6'2". so I've always been one that has been, you know, not one to easily cower or to stand down. So I really just kind of, you know, did what I could with what I had. And I was still able to get some good experience and still get some good deals for clients. Now, for the second part of your question, after I completed Gideon's Promise, and what Gideon's Promise did for me was to give me the legal basis to stand on what I already was doing. I already knew, you know, I had the passion. I was going to get out there and fight, but Gideon's Promise gave me a network of people who were similarly situated so that I wouldn't feel burned out. It's like when you have that brother or sister there to say, hey, I'm going through just what you're going through, it's like, oh, my God, somebody understands. So it gave me that venue. It gave me people who had been where I was, and it also gave me the legal acumen, the cases, and the how-to. You know, law school doesn't teach you how to practice law. They give you all this theory, and it means nothing practically. So it gave me all the tools that I needed to go in there with my feisty self and say, hey, not only do I have this big mouth, but I am also well-read in so-and-so case says, and I know I can do this because this rule says. And then that's when, you know, the change began to happen inside of me as a lawyer. I began to be more comfortable, more confident, and it just blossomed from there.
Excellent, excellent.
Okay, and Ms. Hall, Lamont Banks here. Good to have you on the show. Appreciate hearing from some good attorneys out there. I wanted to share something briefly with you and Mr. Rapping. I was wrongfully convicted here in the state of Colorado. I was defended by a public defender in my first trial. I was found guilty in that trial, but I did not blame my attorney for that. I really didn't.
Okay.
I met people, and I tell you and Mr. Rapping this to say to keep on the fight because it is very encouraging. I was sentenced to an indeterminate sentence, in my case, 8 years to life for a crime I did not commit. I went to prison. I did 7 years. My case was overturned by the Court of Appeals. I was retried. The young lady who was on my first trial, co-counsel, with the attorney, was actually the head of the public defender's office here in Colorado Springs. And she was on the case, and she went and found another public defender. But I'm going to tell you, Ms. Hall and Mr. Rapping, I have never met people so sincere that fought for me. I mean, when I tell you you thought they were family. I mean, and I remember when my verdict came down in my case, when the decision came down, because she was the head of the public defender's office, it sent shockwaves throughout the whole courthouse when the verdict came back not guilty. And I was told by other people, wow, as I was going back to the jail to go back there for the last time, that they were going through their trials, and there was interruption of clapping and all kind of stuff going on in that courthouse because of what they had done. They fought for me. And they believed in me. So I'm aware, as we sit here tonight and discuss the struggles and the challenges that the public defender's office are facing, I will never forget those two young ladies in my trial to the day that I die. I will never forget that. And they fought for me. They came and saw me. They encouraged me and made me believe that there was a chance that I could win. And so what you're telling me as far as what's taught in a law school that you learn, yeah, it's the theory, but it takes the fire and the passion, and I think something that's sadly missing in this judicial system, the heart and the human side to care for justice. And I think what you and Mr. Rapping, I was sharing earlier on the program that I saw the HBO special of Gideon's Army and was moved to tears when I saw that. And I just want to salute you and Mr. Rapping, and I want to share that brief story because we don't hear a lot of the good, but that's one of the good stories. And I feel you and Mr. Rapping are part of the good guys.
Well let me say this. That's an amazing story, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. And I also have to say you saw the movie, which shows these three amazing young lawyers, Travis, Brandy, and June. June actually was
a colleague of Jacinta's in Jackson, Mississippi. And you see those three, and I think, you know, it's a 90-minute movie, so it can only do so much. But what you don't realize is that those three are part of this amazing community that includes lawyers like Jacinta and 300 other young lawyers who have gone through this program, who are collectively supporting each other and cheering each other on. So, you know, you ask how we're going to get through this. I think Cliff asked that right before Jacinta got on the phone. And I say, when you have an army of young people like Jacinta Hall, who are as committed as they are, right, I feel like, how are we not going to get through this? Right, that's sure. just what it takes.
Right, right. And I guess for both of you, and I would like for Jacinta to address this first, and then you, Mr. Rapping. This is an article that we got. It's entitled, "What is Justice if Prosecutors Can Lie and Cheat?" And just an excerpt from it. It says, "A big enough challenge when everybody plays things right." And it's talking about when you're charged with a crime, being in a rough spot and all that. It says, "It's a big enough challenge when everybody plays things straight. But what about when a prosecutor is willing to lie, given that prosecutors often face no consequences for misconduct? Some are willing to do just that." And this is a case in California. It says, "In negotiating a plea deal, a Kern County prosecutor committed what the state's appeal court called outrageous government misconduct. What prosecutor Robert Murray did was produce a translated transcript of the defendant's interrogation to which Murray, the prosecutor, added a false confession. The defense attorney got a copy of the audio tape. It ended abruptly. Eventually, Murray admitted to falsifying the transcript, presumably in the hopes of coercing a plea deal or ensuring a trial victory. When the trial judge found out, charges against the defendants were dismissed. Incredibly, the state attorney general, Kamala Harris, decided to appeal the case, arguing that putting a fake confession in the transcript wasn't outrageous because it didn't involve physical brutality. Total insanity. A state appeals court didn't buy Harris's argument, and the defendant went free. Murray has suffered no punishment, though the State Bar of California is seeking to suspend him. We all in this room and on the phone know that that probably will not happen. Jacinta, when you hear something like this, and given the fact that prosecutors are immune as long as they're so-called, quote-unquote, doing their job, that they have this blanket immunity, when you're fighting for someone else's life, you're putting your passion on the line. You're saying, I'm giving everything that I got. It's not about the money. It's about getting justice for my client by using the law, by using the evidence, by using everything that I can justly to, if the person is guilty, then if I can get them a lesser sentence. If they're innocent, I want to get them off. What is your take on when a prosecutor takes this route?
I've read that story when it first happened, and I mean, it's appalling, but then again, it happens so much. We talk about that all the time at the Shelby County Public Defender's Office, where I am now, that, you know, the prosecutors are quick to point out or to say or assume that something that we're saying is untrue. Mm-hmm. But the court takes their word, everything they say is like gold. And
right.
Nobody questions it. Nobody assumes that they're lying. But it's like, as soon as we say something, oh, I need proof. Really? So are we all officers of the court? But we're to assume that you're telling the truth and I'm lying. Really? And I mean, it happens far too much. And, mm-hmm. you know, these instances are popping up. You know, you've got you got the Ninth Circuit out there that are strong enough to say, hey, this is wrong and this is what we're going to do. But that kind of behavior happens all the time. And I have had to go into court when I was in Jackson. I kept my read receipt. I kept my emails. I very rarely had phone conversations about cases because I knew I couldn't prove what you told me on the phone. But I
right.
can prove what I sent to you in the email, and I can prove that you read what I sent you in the email. So I would keep those things, and they would come into court. I didn't get that. Oh, you didn't? Oh, well, there's an email that says you read it at 6:43 on April the 17th. And it's just like, you know, they do it all the time. But then when they do it, the court doesn't say, well, Mr. or Ms. So-and-so explained. They just say, okay, and they move on. But if it
right.
was the other way around, I would get a tongue lashing like none other. Somebody would call my boss, you know, your lawyer is unethical in everything. It is so unfair. So unfair.
Absolutely.
I'm right there with you. I think that that immunity should be flushed, and the prosecutor should be held as accountable as the defendant. If you get caught committing a crime, you're caught committing a crime, no matter who you are. If you're a prosecutor, you work for the state, you commit a crime by false evidence. Like this, I mean, this man created a confession.
That's a premeditated act.
I mean, he then admitted it. Nothing happened to him. That's sickening. Mr. Rappin, what's your take on this?
Well, I think this is just another piece of evidence that shows that we have come to accept a criminal justice narrative where, rather than the presumption of innocence, we believe in the presumption of guilt. We
Yes.
believe that everyone in the system deserves to be locked away. And really, we've come to embrace a criminal justice system where the goal of prosecutors, and sadly far too often judges, is to make sure that person standing there in the orange jumpsuit goes into a prison cell. And they forget that the process matters. The ends justify the means. And I think it's critically important that defense lawyers continue to be the ones reminding people in the system and the public that justice in America depends on process, that we have to make sure people play by the rules and that the rules are fair. And so, is it infuriating? Absolutely, it's infuriating. But all we can do is keep trying to fight against, and while we're fighting in the system, keep trying to change that narrative externally. So I think about what Dawn Porter did when she made Gideon's Army, right? That was seizing an opportunity to educate the public about injustice, to change that criminal justice narrative a little bit. When you guys decide to do this show and you invite us on to talk and give us the opportunity to talk, you are seizing an opportunity to chip away a little bit more at this accepted narrative of guilty until proven innocent. And I think that we need to just continue working to chip away at this narrative until we finally do embrace these really important principles that make America great in theory. We've got to get there in reality.
And, Mr. Rapping, there is, I was looking at one of the, or an excerpt from, I guess, a book or some of the instruction material that you use in Gideon's Promise. And sort of to piggyback on what Cliff was just talking about, there's one excerpt out there that you wrote, and it says, "Who's guarding the hen house? How the American prosecutor came to devour those he is sworn to protect." And in there's also a chapter that talks about dehumanizing the accused. Mm-hmm. And so talk to us a little bit about that. I mean, we all understand, and I think we all kind of share the same thoughts when it comes to, like Cliff was saying, you know, there should not be blanket immunity. There should not be a situation where a prosecutor can walk into a courtroom and do whatever he wants to do and not even expect to get a hand slap.
Yeah, so, I mean, what I'm really saying in that piece is that we have socialized prosecutors to believe their job is to lock away bad people by any means necessary. And over the last 40 years or so, we've given them tools that will allow them to cut corners if they want to. And of course they want to. So those tools include an ever-growing criminal code that criminalizes more and more behavior. Every one of us breaks multiple laws every day. We don't even know all of the things we do that violate some code provision. So there's this increasing number of codes. There is this use of pretrial detention, where bonds are set that people cannot make for minor offenses. And when someone is locked away in a jail cell and the only way out is to pay a bond they can't make or take a plea, many people
take plea offers. And then there's increasingly harsh sentences with mandatory minimum components. And so what prosecutors do is even though a trial is supposed to be the means by which we determine what actually happened, prosecutors have figured out a way to make sure no one goes to trial. Over 95% of the people accused of crimes in this country resolve their cases through plea offers because prosecutors can stack charges, overcharge, hold someone on bond they can't make, threaten them with an incredibly lengthy sentence, and then coerce them into taking pleas. And so what I'm really saying in that article is that in theory, prosecutors are supposed to be ministers of justice. They are supposed to be the people in the system who make sure that outcomes are fair. They have strayed so far from that because they believe their role is to lock people up, they have the tools to do it, and they have taken advantage of it. And so we've lost our way, and prosecutors are going to have to be, reforming prosecutors is going to have to be part of the solution.
All right. Do you both have a little bit more time to hang out with us?
Sure.
If Jacinta wants to stay, I'll certainly stay.
Yeah, we have a few more questions for you, and we often like to, on these types of discussions, sometimes we like to bring in the IRP 6 case, one of the cases that a Just Cause is fighting for. So we'll talk about that on the other side of the break, but we need to take a quick break. We'll come back in a moment. And during the break, we're going to do our profile of the wrongfully convicted, and tonight we're going to be talking about Timothy Johnson and his case. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our special guests this evening are Jonathan Rapping, the founder and president of Gideon's Promise, along with Jacinta Hall, who is the assistant public defender in Memphis, Tennessee, and she's also a graduate of the Gideon's Promise program. So we ask that you just sit with us. If you have any questions or comments, join us in the chat room or give us a call at 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. At the inception of A Just Cause Coast to Coast, the host and crew decided to devote a segment of each show to an exoneree moment. The purpose of the exoneree moment was to outline the case and highlight the circumstances that led to a wrongful conviction. AJC Radio also wanted to highlight the successes and failures of the justice system, understanding why the system failed and what ultimately turned the tide and cleared their name. We wanted to hear the personal first-hand accounts. They were appalling, emotional, astounding, and overwhelming. Lives devastated by the system. Most of the people who shared their stories were released from the building, but not from the system. They struggled to get their records expunged and clear their names, find suitable employment and housing, obtain restitution from the state, and reconnect with their families and friends. And it hardly fit the definition of exonerated, which means to free from guilt of blame, to clear from a charge of guilt or fault, to exculpate. These are the stories of lives taken and returned, but must be rebuilt, adapted, reestablished, and transformed. The profile of a wrongly convicted.
Profile features Timothy Johnson. On September 14, 1984, 24-year-old Teresa Stanley, the clerk at a Quickie convenience store in Warner Robins, Georgia, was found in the store shortly before 9 p.m. She had been shot in the neck. Stanley died 2 days later without identifying her attacker. A convicted felon and police informant named Mark Davis showed up and told officers that the killer was 22-year-old Timothy Johnson and that Johnson had told him a week earlier that he had planned to rob the store. Johnson was charged with capital murder and armed robbery and aggravated assault. Police also arrested Johnson's disabled mother, his stepfather, and his girlfriend and charged them all with helping Johnson dispose of proceeds of the crime. Johnson pled guilty to murder and 2 counts of armed robbery. He was sentenced to 3 consecutive terms of life in prison. Charges against Johnson's stepfather, mother, and girlfriend were also dismissed. In October 2001, Johnson filed a written motion to vacate his guilty plea. Johnson claimed that there were several witnesses who could have testified that he was not involved in Stanley's murder and robbery. Johnson claimed that there were several witnesses who could have testified that he was not involved in Stanley's murder and robbery because he was somewhere else at the time. The motion was denied in 2002. The petition was denied, but he was allowed to appeal the decision to the Georgia Supreme Court. In 2006, the Supreme Court granted Johnson's motion, vacated the guilty plea, and ordered a new trial. An attorney was appointed to represent him, and he took sworn depositions of two of Johnson's witnesses and a written statement from a third who corroborated Johnson's claim. By the time the murder case came to trial in 2013, more than 7 years after the Georgia Supreme Court decision, the prosecution was no longer seeking the death penalty, and much of the evidence in that case had been lost. Most of the critical witnesses for both the prosecution and defense were unavailable because they were dead or could not be found. On December 5th, 2013, after a four-day trial, a Hudson County Superior Court jury acquitted Johnson, and he was released. This has been a profile of the wrongly convicted with AJC Radio. The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Joining us are Jonathan Rapping and Jacinta Hall, both of Gideon's Promise. And welcome again to the program. Cliff, you had a quick question that you wanted to follow up with.
Right. Well, I was... Yes, as far as that article that I talked about with the Kern County, California prosecutor who created a confession and all the things that happened there, the op-ed piece says that there's three things that need to happen. First, courts should sanction prosecutors directly and personally for misconduct. Second, legislators need to pass laws promoting accountability and ensuring that prosecutorial misconduct is policed by someone other than the same prosecutor's offices. And third, the notion of absolute immunity for prosecutors, which has no basis in the law or the Constitution, needs to be abolished. And I'm sure both of you know that, you know, this law of absolute immunity was brought about some years ago by prosecutors and judges that they, you know, created for themselves, that, you know, under the roof that, well, we don't want to get sued for doing our job because otherwise, you know, everybody would be suing us, which I don't think is a really good defense. If you didn't do anything wrong, somebody sues you, a judge will say, hey, this lawsuit has no basis, we'll throw it out. But with that being said, and these three things, I mean, if they come to pass in any of our lifetimes, I would be surprised. But outside of those three things, sanctioning the prosecutors, passing legislation, and then the, you know, abolishing that law or that rule about absolute immunity, what do you guys think can be done about these prosecutors with misconduct? I mean, Jacinta, you said, hey, it happens all the time. You know, I go in court, the prosecutor pretty much is going to try to get away with something that is not true, that is not according to the law. But I mean, what do you do to try to, you know, thwart this until some of these other actions, real actions, actually get done?
Well, I mean, there is recourse, but the recourse that we as lawyers have is that if you see what you deem to be unethical conduct, is to go before the tribunal in your state or your jurisdiction and file an essential bar complaint. But, you know, as even though, you know, we're opposing counsel with prosecutors, you know, when you go and you file a bar complaint before the committee, that somebody is engaging in unethical behavior. I mean, unless it's like something extremely egregious, you know, that's just something that you don't want to do to another lawyer. And so it, you know, kind of leads into, you know, a contentious situation with the opposing counsel that you have to appear before and try to get subsequent cases worked out with. So even though there is recourse, it's basically no recourse because there's no kind way other than telling a judge that, hey, you know, this is going on and this is impacting my client, you know, negatively, and the judge saying, oh, whatever, or ignoring it, or, you know, kind of, hey, don't do that again, pat, pat on the hand. I mean, there's really nothing to be done. One thing you did say, though, is that one thing that the op-ed mentioned is a neutral tribunal. And I think that that's something that needs to happen, just like we have, especially now, since we've had all of the killings done by police officers, people are talking about having, like, community boards or people who are neutral coming in and overseeing the police department or a complaint, you know, a venue for people to have outside of the police department, because when you complain against an officer, you have to do it inside the department. So something like that needs to happen inside the court system as well. Look, if we got something going on where we feel like there is something, you know, under the table going on to negatively affect my client and his liberty, there should be an opportunity for that client to go before whomever and say, look, this is what happened to me. This is what was done to me. And, I mean, there's a case right now here in Memphis where the District Attorney General of Shelby County here in Memphis put a note inside of a file that said, do not show to the defense. And the prosecutor who was trying the case and the defense attorney saw the note, and that person was convicted. And it was mentioned as well as some other evidence that wasn't turned over, and his case came back on appeal. Well, when it came back on appeal, they couldn't find the note. They never could find the note again. And they actually called her on the stand to testify to say, hey, where's this note? And then she said, I don't recall it. But other than them, nothing happened to her. She's still the District Attorney General of Shelby County.
Right, and Jacinta, see, we've heard before where people say, well, one attorney doesn't want to bring another attorney up on, you know, up to the board or up on charges or whatever. Make me understand why an attorney would, if you say, okay, me as an attorney, I'm fighting for justice, I'm doing what's right, and then I find a crooked attorney, why would you not want to expose that attorney? And I understand the part that, well, you know, doing your job, you might have to come to some type of deal with a plea. But when you say, okay, I found this attorney to be crooked, just like this example you just gave, this DA puts a note in there, don't show it to the prosecutor. You get don't show it to the defense. Then you get the prosecutor on the stand. Oh, I don't recall. So I'm not lying. I just really don't remember exactly what. Why would you not want to expose that attorney to say, you know what, this is a bad apple that gives the prosecutors the bad name? Why not take them to the board? Why not say, hey, some sanctions need to come against them? And you know, frankly, why don't they deserve to go to jail?
Well, actually, I mean, that's egregious. I mean, what's going on in that case, and I believe that client's case is on retrial right now. That's egregious. And I don't know what they've done. I don't know, you know, this was not a public defender case. I don't know what that attorney has done or what's going to happen going forward with how that client wishes to proceed against the prosecution in that case. I don't know. They may very well have gone before the Board of Professional Responsibility here in Tennessee. I don't know. But, I mean, that's egregious. But you have to discuss that, you know, with the client, because you do represent the client, and I have to do what my client advises me to do. And they themselves can file a complaint as well. It doesn't have to be me filing against another lawyer. You know, clients can file grievances against attorneys all the time, and they should. But, you know, you have to make sure that client is aware of whatever consequences, say, if for whatever reason they are brought up before the tribunal again and this attorney's not gone, this prosecutor. You know, what's going to happen? But you absolutely make them aware of their options. And if they want to proceed, then, you know, as an attorney, look, I may not can't represent you here before this tribunal, but this is what you have to do. in order to get what you need done.
And Lamont Banks here, I want to chime in a little bit on this. I think, and I'm not saying you, Ms. Hall, I'm saying, and we talk about this over and over again, you know, the prosecution and the system is set up to, they have a thing called the Habitual Act here in Colorado Springs that's on the state books here, as far as state legislation, as far as the law, where they can give you the prosecution, and it goes back to what Mr. Rapping was saying earlier, they threaten people with outrageous sentences, and this is just a double standard to me, that they can come after you. And there was a lady who is spending life in prison right now, a friend of mine, who I met while I was wrongfully incarcerated, but I was in county jail fighting the second trial. And she had two issues against her, and she went to an ATM machine, did not take money off of the card, looked at the balance of an associate's credit card. They gave her the habitual, which is almost double or three times the amount of time you would normally get on a particular sentence, and said, well, you had the intent or the attempt to take this money, so we're going to give you the habitual. Well, the law reads it has to be a similar crime. But the abuse of the prosecution's office, and I think we say all the time, you know what, we don't, you know, we, you know, as soon as something happens in this country, you'll get the top people in this country of law enforcement get on TV and say, well, this is a nation of laws, and we have to live by those laws. You know what? No, it's a double standard. It's unequal justice, whether it's for minorities and the white people here in America, that we suffer at the hands. And as I'm hearing you talk and share, I'm hearing culture all over the place. The culture is we just don't do that. We don't go primarily. And to me, what may be egregious to you or not egregious to you may be egregious to me. You know what I mean? How do we make that judgment?
You know, Lamont, I think you are hitting on the crucial aspect of this, and that is this issue of culture, right? We are in a system where cutting corners by prosecutors has become the norm, right? It's normalized, and so everyone accepts it. When you ask for a prosecutor to be punished, people look at you sideways, like, are you kidding me? That's not how we do things. And so there is this sort of culture. And so really the question you're asking, I think, is bigger than how do we discipline one prosecutor. It's how do we change a culture. And so what we're really doing through Gideon's Promise is trying to change a culture of indigent defense, a culture where well-intentioned public defenders can learn that processing cases is their job, that you don't go visit your clients at the jail because they never give you useful information, that you can look at a police report and know that a case should be pled out. Those are all things that they learn in the system. And we are working with lawyers early on to give them a different value set so they can resist and ultimately change that culture. I actually think when you ask how do we change the culture of prosecutors, which is just as important, I think we have to ask ourselves, what role should law schools play? Because as Jacinta described, she came out of law school a blank slate. There was nothing in law school that taught her how to be a public defender. She began learning on the job, right? Sure. She got to Gideon's Promise, and Gideon's Promise helped shape her. But many lawyers don't, and they're shaped by an office that has also come to accept processing human beings. Well, prosecutors come out of law school, they don't know anything about the job, and they go into a prosecutor's office where they learn how to prosecute. And if every senior prosecutor they see are cutting corners and saying, look, we hide this evidence because otherwise a bad guy's going to go free, they start learning to do that. And so law schools need to start training law students about their ethical and professional obligations as defense lawyers, as prosecutors, so students come out and recognize
that culture is something that is unjust and refuse to participate in it and demand to be a part of change.
Anyway, and what Rep is saying is true. And what he's saying about the culture is true. If, and like I stated before, with that particular case and the district attorney general here, I don't know what's happened. But if no complaint is filed, it will be because of the culture of practice here that, you know, hey, we don't want to do that to you. You know, we don't want you punished for that. You know, we understand. And I think that sometimes that's a fallacy because you've got this client here who has been punished, who has been in prison, and this guy has been in prison for almost 10 years, I believe, for something that he's stating that he did not do. And if he gets convicted a second time, we'll have to go back to prison for something that he said he did not do because he didn't have everything he needed, and the prosecutors knew that.
And I think
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Quick, really quick point, but to Lamont's point, and as Jacinta was just talking about, when I first came to Georgia just started a statewide public defender system. We got all the public defenders together for a training, and we did a session on client-centered representation, and we talked about the importance of caring about your clients, of learning what your clients want out of the representation, of not substituting your judgment for theirs. And afterwards, one of the kind of lawyers who'd been practicing 30 years raised his hand and said, I don't understand this stuff about bending over backwards for these clients. I went to law school. The judge went to law school. The prosecutor went to law school. We're all officers of the court. We're all part of the same club. My client's not an officer of the court. They're not part of that club. And that's a culture that lawyer learned over 30 years, that no matter how hard you fight in court during the day, that prosecutor and that judge, you all are in some ways kind of part of a little family. And then it becomes, they learn to not go tell on each other, to not take their grievances outside of the little courtroom. And who suffers? The client, the person who we are charged with protecting.
Sure.
Lisa, go ahead.
What I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there is a standard that's set in place that we don't mess with our own. That's what I'm hearing.
Absolutely.
Is that nobody wants to mess with their own. And I think that is about the sickest crap I have ever heard in my life. I have a client who's not a part of this good old boy network, so therefore he gets screwed in the butt. He doesn't get taken care of. He just gets left out there to deal with whatever because we really don't want to mess with this attorney. We really don't want to bring him up on sanction. We really don't want to get him in any trouble. I have such a problem with that. That to me, I've never heard anything so sick in all my life. And I'm sorry.
Lisa, can I say, first of all, it's nice to meet you. Second of all, I think the fact that you have a problem with that is because you're an individual who cares about justice. Anyone who hasn't lost sight of justice would have a problem with it. But it is the culture that we send young lawyers into. And if we don't change that culture is going to shape these young lawyers. And so I think there is nothing more important in this effort to reform criminal justice than to change that culture. And I think that's what we're trying to do with public defenders through Gideon's Promise. And the article that we talked about earlier, Who's Guarding the Hen House, was a plea to try to do something similar with prosecutors who have also lost their way.
And to change that culture, I mean, if you look at it from a state or federal level, to change that culture, where do we start? I mean, do we start at, like, say, in Colorado, do we start at the Colorado State Attorney's Office? Here it's John Walsh. And, you know, to kind of put it in perspective, if we look at the IRP 6, this is a federal case. You have the six men. They're brought up on charges for really what was corporate debt. And the things that the prosecutor did during that trial were just phenomenal. You're talking about gathering bank records with no subpoena. Witness tampering with the defendant's witnesses.
Two grand juries,
just everything that he could do that says, I'm getting this conviction. Where does it start? I mean, if you're not going to say, okay, attack this particular, and when I say attack, I mean with the law through the process, attack this particular assistant U.S. attorney, do you go to the U.S. attorney's office and say, you know, I mean, if you go to the U.S. attorney's office, it's kind of useless to say, hey, one of your attorneys did this, because then you're doing an internal audit. You're basically, that's the fox watching the hen house. That's you saying, okay, I'm basically going to bring charges up against myself or not my people. It's not going to work. And that's why, to Lisa's point, it's like, okay, why, if someone in your profession is wrong, if they're, it's like a cop saying, okay, I'm not going to tell on the crooked cop, the one that's taking money, the one that's, you know, got people out on the street dealing drugs or running a prostitution ring. That me, you know, as a brother in blue, I'm not going to mess with him because that's the culture we protect our own instead of exposing the dirt that's going on. So, I mean, to get this culture to change, where do we start? Where do you bring the hammer of justice down to say this is the beginning of the changing of the culture?
Yeah, so I'm not saying that we don't try to expose wrongdoing when we see it. I do think because we've come to accept this wrongdoing so much, only if it's really egregious will anyone do anything about it. Not that we shouldn't try, but I think the answer has to be larger than just waiting for people to break the rules and exposing them. That should be part of it, but we've got to do more. We have to change the way we think about justice. So I think, for example, I just watched the movie Selma. I took my 10-year-old daughter, and I thought about these young people, a lot of them younger than the public defenders we work with, who were in Alabama and Mississippi, really trying to change a culture that probably at the time seemed impossible to change, a culture where we didn't accept black people as human beings, we didn't think they should be allowed to vote, let alone get married, and it seemed impossible. But there were a group of people who certainly they were pushing for rules to change, legislative reform. But more than that, at the heart of that movement was changing the hearts and minds of America, was saying, look, it's not enough that you make a law that says black people can vote, and black people vote because we have to let them vote. We want more. We want to get to a point where, as a nation, we believe black people should be allowed to vote because we've changed their hearts and minds. And I think it's hard to imagine we could get there. But we've made progress. There's a long way to go, but we've made progress. I think that's where we are in the criminal justice system. I think we are looking at these problems that seem intractable, but I think we have a small army, and it's growing, and part of what we're doing is trying through every channel that we can find to start changing the hearts and minds of people in the system and beyond to understand that what's happening is unjust, it's undemocratic, it's un-American. And I believe that 40 years from now, our children will know a more humane criminal justice system because of the work that young folks like Jacinta and Travis and Brandy and June are doing on the front lines of criminal justice today.
So, Mr. Rapping and Ms. Hall, got a quick question for you as far as, now, obviously, it seems as though Gideon's Promise, there's a lot of focus on the judicial process at the local, state level, and so forth. And I'll start off. Part one is there a federal equivalent of Gideon's Promise, or is there a track in Gideon's Promise that helps with CJA attorneys? And the reason I ask that is, as Cliff was talking about the IRP6 earlier, they had CJA attorneys, and as Cliff indicated, I'm not going to go through all the things that I'm not going to repeat all the things he said, but there were so many things in this case that pointed to the fact that these gentlemen are innocent. And they have been wrongfully convicted. So they go to their CJA attorneys, and they say, we want to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office. We have a proffer. We understand, you know, we want to lay it out, how we were conducting business, that it is business, that there was nothing criminal going on. And everyone that's looked at it even since then say, where's the crime? In this situation, the CJA attorneys, in a meeting, all aligned together and basically said that they were not going to agree to a meeting with the U.S. attorney in Denver. That is the most disservice to their clients, being the IRP-6. How can we prevent that kind of thing from happening? I mean, they should have, like Ms. Hall was saying earlier, and like you were saying, Mr. Rapping, you roll up your sleeves and you jump into the ring and you just fight until it's over, until, you know, last man standing kind of thing. But in this situation, and the IRP-6, they knew, they even signed agreements with the U.S. Attorney's Office saying that if we have misrepresented anything in this proffer, if we have indicated that we didn't do something, but you find out that we did do something, and you're going to come after us and add more charges on top of that. We enter this thing with our eyes wide open, and we know that what the consequences are. The U.S. Attorney's Office eventually reviewed the proffer because the CJA attorneys didn't go with them, but the U.S. Attorney's Office reviewed the proffer, couldn't come back with a rebuttal. They could not dispute what was in that proffer, yet they proceeded on with the trial. In the meantime, the guys ended up firing the CJA attorneys because they would not represent them. They would not sit down and put together a strategy. It was like Cliff talked about earlier as far as restrictions on amount of time and money and so forth. After that 77 hours was up, it was as if the CJA attorney said, hey, actually one of them did tell David Banks, one of the IRP-6, you don't have any say in this case. There is no strategy that you can discuss. Your only job is to decide on what kind of plea you're going to take. How can that be?
Well, the way that can be is that the nation is filled with criminal justice professionals, defense lawyers, prosecutors, judges. It goes back to the fact that they've lost sight of justice, right? They've accepted a really unjust system. I mean, you ask if there's
Kool-Aid.
They drink the Kool-Aid, right? And you ask if there's a Gideon's Promise for CJA lawyers or the federal bar. My hope is that there will be one day. You know, 8 years ago, we started with 16 lawyers, two offices, and one program. Today, we have over 400 lawyers, five different programs. We're in 16 different states. We started with the state system, because although there are problems everywhere, the state systems are more fractured than the federal system, right? When you, in relative terms, the federal system is light years ahead of many state systems. And we started in the South because there's a real concentration of broken state systems in the South, although they're all over the country. But we're growing, and my hope is that as we build support, as we do more outreach, as people learn about us and they help us build the support, we will ultimately spread across the country and into the federal system. But I do think this is a marathon. I know it's cliche, but this is a marathon, not a sprint. We've been patient for 8 years, and we've grown from 16 lawyers to 400, and we've got a lot more work to do.
And Mr. Rapping and Ms. Hall, I want to see what your thoughts are on this. As you're talking, and I'm sitting here thinking the same thing, that, a Gideon army of prosecutors is something that's definitely needed. I will say this, that I believe because of the corruption of the judges, that makes the battle that much more difficult. We say who can be accountable, will prosecutors change their act? Then you have to, it's like a tier effect of change that has a culture that has the change. You have judges that sit up here that have the power to not allow such conduct. Leadership in DA's offices. We had a guest on the show last week, a state attorney, Nurheim, from Illinois, which sounded like a Gideon's army to me.
From the prosecution side
of things. And we were so impressed, and basically in a state of shock the entire two-hour show. We had never heard nothing like that before, and which is sad to say that we heard the good side of a prosecutor, because it is so rare in the land today. When we heard it, we were like, really? Hold on, let me see if I'm awake right now. And I think, you'll have the federal government come out and they'll make statements and say, you know what, we're going to hold prosecutors accountable, we're going to hold attorneys accountable, we need to reform the justice system. Well, that starts at the top with the judges, mm-hmm. who are sitting in position that are openly breaking the law. But because, I mean, if you think people don't want to challenge another attorney because of this good old boys network, try attacking a judge and his conduct. You know what I mean?
I think it's
even worse. Go ahead, Ms. Hall.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I was going to comment on what you were speaking about judges, and there's an issue that is going on right now in Hinds County in Jackson, Mississippi, where I was with a judge that has essentially kicked the public defender's office out of his courtroom. The lady who is the primary defender, the first chair in that courtroom now, is one who is very outspoken, and she's a zealous advocate, and she's been doing quite well. Her percentage of, getting great outcomes, including winning at trials, is high. And he doesn't like that. And so what he's done is he's barred her from the court. And then they went in, my former boss and all of my former colleagues went in court and tried to assume the representation of cases that we had previously been appointed on. And he had my former boss forcibly removed from the courtroom by a sheriff's deputy.
Now, see, how does that happen and there is no recourse?
Exactly.
Who comes after this judge?
That's the point.
That's the problem. And that's the problem. There is, like I said, there's recourse. There is a tribunal for judges that you complain to, just like you do with lawyers. And then they also have filed a writ to the Mississippi Supreme Court. They're just waiting. And, it takes time to get things worked out, unfortunately. But the most egregious thing about him, though, is not even that. What a coworker told me, and I know firsthand because before I moved to Memphis, I was in his courtroom, and he treated me like crap, but I didn't care because I was going to do whatever it was that I was going to do. What she told me was, she was like, when the news cameras left from them having my former boss escorted, he went right back to his same shenanigans. A man was testifying about his inability to afford an attorney because he only made $7.50 an hour. And do you know what that judge told the man? He said, "Do you have a car?" The man said, "Yes." He said, "Well, sell your car so you can hire an attorney."
Wow.
That's not the Constitution. That's not the law.
No, it's not. Well, we have run out of time. Founder and president Jonathan Rapping of Gideon's Promise, and also with us Jacinta Hall, an assistant public defender out of Memphis, Tennessee. We certainly appreciate you both hanging out with us this evening and talking about how we can help the public defenders. And folks can go out and where can they go, Mr. Rapping, to your website as far as getting more information about Gideon's Promise?
Sure. www.gideonspromise.org. One word, Gideon's Promise.
www.gideonspromise.org. Again, thank you both for joining us. For archives of this program, we invite our listeners to go to ajcradio.com. Again, that's ajcradio.com. Thanks again for joining us. Have a good evening, both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lisa, let's talk about the IRP6 and GoFundMe.
Yes.
Yep. Sorry, my mic was off. Yeah, we want to just tell everybody to go out to GoFundMe.com. I'll remind you just one last time, GoFundMe.com. Do a search on IRP6, and you're able to find a link out there that will allow you to donate to the families of these wrongfully convicted gentlemen that need your help.
Also, for other programming with a Just Cause, you can go to Live365.com for 24/7 programming. Catch us each Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time at the Progressive Radio Network, and you can get there by going to prn.fm. Also, for on-demand programming, you can go to the405radio.com or iTunes. If you'd like more information on A Just Cause, please go to www.a-justcause.com. And we would also ask that you click on the donate button there. A Just Cause is a 501c3, and we would appreciate anything you can assist with on that clip.
I want to say thank you to our guests, Jonathan Rapping and Jacinta Hall. Thank you for taking time out of your evening to spend to us. We enjoyed your enlightening conversation.
To our production team, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson of K&D Productions, helping out Ill Skillers Girl in the control room to make sure that you hear what it is that we have to say. To our production support crew, they bring us accurate and up-to-date information so we can pass that on to you. To the truth, we know you out there. We appreciate it.
Lisa.
I want to say thank you to Olivia and Miss Barbara, who are out doing behind-the-scenes work that make things go smoother. We appreciate you guys.
Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. You heard us talking a little bit earlier about the IRP6. Keep the IRP6 in your prayers. That's David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice every Tuesday and Thursday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. I wish we could have talked a little bit more about that with Mr. Rapping and Ms. Hall. That was very insightful, and it went right down the line as far as the information and education as far as what we provide. But anyway, we're at the end of another one. I'm Sam Thurman on behalf of Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Good night, America.
Good night.
Good night.